stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview that I did with actor, director, teacher, producer, and delightful interview, Bruce Jordan, who is currently directing a production of The Underpants for Florida Studio Theater. This is the third time that Bruce has directed a production of this play, which was adapted by Steve Martin. He has a lot to say about the play, but also about life, about acting, and all of what he says is interesting and often very funny. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive. Finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from no.
Is about knowing who you really are so that you can live the life you were really meant to live. If you've been listening, you hear me say every week that as a psychotherapist, I believe we come out of childhood pretending to be less than we are. That most of us, maybe all of us, learn in our childhood that some qualities, some ways of being, some aspects of us are not going to bring us the result, the reaction that we want. Well, what do we want? We always want the same thing. We want to be loved. We want to be appreciated. We want to be valued. We want to be told that we're fine. It is getting that, getting the feeling, the certainty that you are loved, that you are important, that you are fine just the way you are. That's the foundation on which we can build a successful life. Successful in my terms meaning the life we were meant to live, the life that feels right, the life that when we wake up in the morning, it's the one we want. How many of us can say that when we wake up in the morning, we are waking up to the life we were meant to live? The life we want to live, the life we're happy to live? Well, unfortunately, not that many of us. And for some, the reason that we're not living the life we meant to live is that we are not having complete access to who we really are, to all of what we can do, or all of what our instincts suggest to us feel right. Now, how can this happen? I talk a lot about the impact that our families have on us, and obviously they are the laboratory in which we experiment with how to be and what to do and what's going to work and what's going to fail. So if you are a basically outgoing, sort of in your face, very forthright, say what you mean, maybe even explosive, happy-go-lucky kid, and you happen to be born into a family that believes the old, saying, children should be seen and not heard, or that a certain kind of exuberance is unfortunate, unpleasant, ugly, dangerous, then the very first times that you express your exuberance, your joy, yourself, you are going to get a reaction that lets you know that that is not okay. And that reaction can be anything from a frown, the raising of eyebrows, the turning away of the beloved parent instead of the turning to. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, it can be criticism. It can be, don't do that. It can be, go to your room. It can be a slap. I mean, there are all kinds of ways, that some subtle and some obvious and terrible. But all of them will work to discourage that behavior. So you begin to try and put a lid on that behavior. When you have the impulse to laugh out loud, to yell, to jump up and down, I don't know, you begin to be able to curb that, and over time the impulse to curb it becomes so reflexive that you no longer have the impulse. You no longer think of yourself as someone who dances for joy, who acts silly, whatever it was that you decided you needed to curb. And you come into adulthood thinking of yourself as a serious person. You come into adulthood having forgotten that you have this other person. But forgetting doesn't mean that it has gone away. Again, if you've been listening, or if you've read my book, you know that I think that what we are mostly demonstrating is what I call our cover story. So in this case, your cover story is that you are a serious, not silly, not frivolous, not demonstrative person. But your capacity for silliness, for demonstration, is not gone. It has gone undercover. And you are not living the life that you were meant to live, because the life you were meant to live included silliness, included the exuberance, included demonstration of how you feel. And we all know, not necessarily consciously, but we all know when we're not being our true self, what therapists, I being one, of course, call being authentic or being congruent. That is, what I am is what I present, and what you see is what's really there. You know the saying, a lot of people say, if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me, or the feeling that I'm a fraud. That's very popular these days to talk about that feeling. Well, all that is there is something about me which I am not demonstrating, and I think it's not okay. I think that that thing which I am hiding from you is ugly, it's a weakness, it's unpleasant, it's even dangerous. And that were I to be my whole self, were I to let you know, in the case that I'm using, let you know that I'm silly and frivolous and that I can demonstrate expressions and feelings and emotions in a big way, that you would frown, turn away, raise your eyebrows, hit me. Now, of course, that memory is hidden quite deeply undercover, and our brain remembers it and drops a chemical in our bloodstream that keeps the reflex to not do that in place. So the Lynn Show is about making the point that there may be something about you that you have had to hide undercover. And you may be feeling, if you knew me, you wouldn't really like me, or I'm a fraud, or you don't really know me, or those kinds of unpleasant feelings about ourselves, the self-criticism. In the book, I say that so many of us are caught in what I call a civil war. That is, that we are at war with ourselves. The things that we have put undercover, when they try and come up, we shut them down, slap them down with self-criticism. We become the person who doesn't like us. We become the enemy. And of course, this can hardly lead to a happy life. And so many of us are spending so much of our energy telling ourselves there's something wrong with us. That's, of course, at the bottom of so much of the work I do as a therapist, is to help people first to begin to notice that they do it. It's quite remarkable how oblivious we can be to the way in which we undermine ourselves, tear ourselves down, make ourselves feel bad. Then we feel bad and we don't know why. Well, why? Because we've done it to ourselves. We have become the person who is criticizing what is natural to us. And of course, this is a prescription for unhappiness, and it's certainly not a prescription for living the life you were meant to live, and it's not a prescription for waking up in the morning and being glad to find yourself in the life that you find yourself. Now, I've talked about the impact of family quite a lot, but I also know that peers can be the ones who let us know that we're not all right. Schools, teachers can let us know that we're not all right. Culture, our culture, can let us know that we're not all right. And our religions can also tell us that stuff that is natural to us is not okay. All of these institutions, places where we find ourselves, places that are important to us, places where we want to be accepted, appreciated, liked. If you were listening to the show a couple of weeks ago, you heard Mary Testa talk about what happened to her in Catholic school, that she was all the things that they didn't want. They were Irish, she was Italian, she had curly hair, they wanted straight hair, she was outgoing, they thought rather passive little girls were better. So this is not an uncommon experience. I have a story from my family where my mother was in elementary school, and the teacher invited everyone up to come and sing a song or do some kind of performance, and my mother got up. My mother had a very beautiful big belt voice, and she sang a song that was popular at the time. Well, the teacher didn't like that, and my mother remembers very clearly as a very young girl the teacher saying, "Well, how many people like that kind of voice?" And of course, the implication was clear to the rest of the students, and they weren't going to be caught having an opinion that the teacher didn't like. And my mother began over time to lessen the power of that voice. So by the time I knew her, she sang in a very soft voice, and the passion and the energy and the talent, really, that she had gone deeply undercover. Again, the point of the Lynn Show is to say that this happens so much. I think it happens all the time. I think that none of us gets out of childhood with the complete complement of what we were born with. None of us survives intact into adulthood. Many of us get into adulthood with most of who we are, and we don't need to pretend too much, hide too much. Some of us, unfortunately, come out of childhood with the certainty that everything is wrong with us, there's nothing good about us. And of course, that is the job of therapy. The first, as I try and do in this show, the recognition that we're doing that, mostly we just think it's the truth. We don't realize how much we reinfect ourselves with that over and over again, unnecessarily. Secondly, to think about whether there is something we might have wanted to do or be, some way of being that we yearn for or are jealous of or think we might have liked. And then third, to wonder if maybe we want to do something about recovering whatever that might be. As I have mentioned, I wrote a book about this. It's called When You Can, You Will: Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And as I've also mentioned a couple of times, I'm a psychotherapist. This is the work I do. I do all my work on the phone these days. So if you're interested in phone therapy, if you're interested in learning more about how and why you might have hidden some quality, some aspect of yourself, you can get that information on my website, which is thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn, thelynnshow.com. And on my website, you can also get all of my past shows and listen to all of the interviews that I've done. And I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because in order to do that in this culture, it has to be who you really are. We make it so hard for artists here. And so when you listen to someone who is making their living or their life with an art, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. You can hear authenticity. You can hear congruence. And of course, it is my hope that when you hear it, somebody inside of you is jumping up and down saying, wow, I want that. And maybe persuading you to consider recovering some of what you may have lost. So today I am playing an interview with Bruce Jordan, the delightful, the charming, the funny, the inventive Bruce Jordan. If you were listening last week, you heard my interview with Elliot Rains, who thought he wanted to start out being an actor and a director, went to school, started his career, and then realized that acting was not the perfect career for him, and went back to school, became a lawyer, and found that he could change midstream, and that he could be more than he thought he was, and then he can have it all, because now he directs. Bruce Jordan has a similar sort of opposite take on that. Bruce, although he clearly fell in love with acting and performing very, very young, it's an adorable story, which I will let Bruce tell you. But he thought he wanted to be a teacher. He thought he wanted to teach what he loved. And then, in a very ironic twist, which I will again let him tell you, he found that he actually wanted to do it himself, and has made a life of joy. You can hear it in everything he says, of acting, of directing, of producing, of theater, of making other people happy, you know, bringing joy, bringing interest, bringing creativity, bringing invention to millions of people all over the world. You'll hear him talk about that as well. So Bruce is an example of someone who listened to himself. When he found himself in a place he wanted to be, He said, yes, I like this. And he went for it. I'm going to let Bruce tell you all that. Here he is, Bruce Jordan. So I'm here with Bruce Jordan, who is here at Florida Studio Theater directing Underpants, which was written by...
Carl Sternheim in the early 1900s.
Okay, and was...
adapted by Steve Martin.
Yes.
About 15 years ago.
I want to talk about the play, but I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And clearly, you make some of your living, much of your living, some of your life with the art of theater.
All of my living.
All of your living. All of your living, all of your life. That's right. Okay, good. So, I only ask one question, and that is, how did you discover this passion? What was the very first moment in your life when you thought, or someone else told you, that, you know, you were funny, that you got people's attention, that you like being on stage, that you like telling people what to do? I'm not, you know. Do you know what I'm asking?
Yes, I absolutely do, and I can, and I remember it clearly. I mean, I was always kind of the class clown.
Uh-huh.
You know, I spent a lot of my elementary school career with scotch tape on my mouth. You know? But I remember in seventh grade, we did a little assembly program, and it was called Sticks and Bones, and it was this... It was just a simple little one-act play for junior high people, but there was a time in it when I had to dance with a broom, and I was talking to my broom, who was named Matilda, not after the musical, but a lot while before Matilda,
right.
But I remember doing the show, and when Matilda and I were dancing, I got laughs, I mean convulsive laughs in the audience, and it's kind of a little some sort of drug,
yeah,
that you need to get more of. And my heroes were always my junior high and high school drama coaches. My life was always
The seventh grade is junior high.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
It was then, yes.
Right.
I think it still is now. Now it's middle school.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah.
So they had a drama, club, or they had a drama...
We had a drama club.
Which you joined.
Yes.
Which is why you were in Sticks and Bones.
Yes.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
So you already knew that this was something attractive, or you wouldn't have been in the drama club.
Yeah, I didn't know, you know, I mean, you join a lot of things when you're that age, you know. I was in the Cub Scouts, and I didn't make a career being a Cub Scout.
No, but you make an interesting point. I mean, so it didn't, you sort of discovered it.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. I had nobody in my family. You know, sometimes in somebody's family, there's somebody who was in the theater,
right,
or somebody who was a singer, or somebody. I came from a totally arts-free family.
Wow. Right.
So I broke the mold.
Yes, you did. And so here we have you at seventh grade, and you have your, you know, enamored of your drama coach, your drama club teacher, right?
Yes.
Okay. And so were there other plays, other things, or?
Well, we didn't do anything else in junior high, but then
I was just going to ask you, isn't that odd?
Yeah.
I mean, they did this one thing and then they didn't do anything else?
Well, I wasn't in anything
else. Oh, I see.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
All right.
So, but my junior high drama teacher, when I went over to be a freshman in high school, sent over a recommendation to the man, Albert Murphy, who ran the drama program at Amityville Memorial High School in Amityville, Long Island. And so I was, as a freshman, I got to do my first play with the sophomores, juniors, and seniors, which was
a big
deal.
Because the junior high teacher said he's good, or
yes,
use him, or
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, you might want to look at him.
Right.
Yeah,
did
yeah.
you know that?
No, not until a couple of years later, actually. Not until after I graduated.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Mr. Albert A. Murphy. He was our high school, and he taught history during the day and became the head of drama.
And had his passionate. Yeah, right after. Okay, so you were, he took this guy's word for it and he put you in the play.
Yeah.
Do you remember what it was?
Yes, it was The Curious Savage. It was a play that I bet I could remember the author, but on Broadway it had starred Lillian Gish.
Wow.
Yeah, and so it was John, not John Van Druten, but somebody like that, Curious Savage.
Okay.
It was a lightweight comedy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you liked it?
Loved it. Loved it. I played Titus Savage, kind of the money maker of the family.
Wow. Yeah.
And it was all about, the children trying to get the mother's money and having her institutionalized and get her fortune and
all that
kind of stuff.
Yeah. Okay, so confirmed for you that, yeah, this is good,
yeah,
right?
Yes, loved it.
Yeah, so what happened with the rest of your high school career?
Oh, then I did a lot of other things. What else did we do? I played Mr. Torkelson in I Remember Mama. Yeah. I directed in the, we used to have what we called the Dramatic Opportunity Tournament, where the seniors directed the freshmen, the sophomores, and the juniors in one act competition.
This is unusual.
Yeah, it was. And it was a very, very, very rewarding and also educational.
Yes, and very unusual. So were there, so in the drama club, did they also teach directing?
Yeah, well, we had everybody, only the seniors could do it, and each of them had a faculty advisor, let's
really?
Say. Yeah, mm-hmm. And they, so if you had any troubles, you could go to the faculty advisor and say, I don't know what to do about blah, 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 blah. But mostly, it was, I never went to my advisor. I just, maybe that's why I finished
it.
Second instead of winning it.
Yes, but you did finish second.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Out of three.
Very good. Very good. Still class clown. Right? Okay, so, did you want to direct? Were you interested in directing, or were you still thinking?
I had a very nice little acting career. I mean, I knew that I could maybe direct something, but I had a very nice little acting gig. I'd do all the acting in high school, and then when I went on to college, in between my junior and senior year of high school, my guidance counselor told me there was a 6-week course called Elements of Acting being given at Geneseo, which is a State University of New York up near Rochester, and a friend of mine and I both went up to take the course, and I fell in love with Geneseo. I fell in love with that program. I fell in love with theater even more than I already was. And Geneseo was the only university in the state university system that offered a degree in teaching speech and theater.
Ah.
So I was going to become what my heroes were.
Yes.
I was going to become the head
yes.
of a high school.
That's lovely.
And teach young, gifted people.
You were going to give the gift.
Yeah, I was going to try.
Yeah. Okay, so now I'm just curious, because you said none of your family, you come from an arts-free family. I love that. So what did they think of this?
Well, they thought it was great because, it meant that I was going to become a teacher.
Ah, yes, of course. You weren't going to become an actor.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
That was the worst thing that they could imagine.
So this is safe. He's going to become a teacher. Yeah. We don't care what he teaches.
Yeah. Right. Safe and secure.
Safe and secure.
My mom and dad were both Depression grown up.
Right.
Grew up in the Depression, so they wanted to...
Okay, so you apply and you get in
to Geneseo, yeah, mm-hmm. and uh, And they had the most wonderful program. And I had the most wonderful professors. I go back all the time. I'm a big supporter of their alumni association. I'm going back in a couple of weeks. Because, you know, sometimes in life, everything just falls right. I mean, there are enough times when it all falls wrong.
That's right, right. It's good to know that occasionally. Right.
So it all fell right. And it was just like, I devoured everything I needed to know. I had wonderful, wonderful professors. When I go back now, the buildings are named after them. They're all gone now. Right. And I just think how lucky I was, you know, to have these people. So then, I graduate and I have to get a job, you know.
And all along, you're still committed to this is you're going to teach.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, mm-hmm. I had no vision beyond that.
Right.
And then that was going to make me so happy because those were the people I most revered,
yes.
You know.
Yeah.
So, there was a placement office, you know, in senior year, you know, and you look on the board and see who has, which is very rare today, who in a secondary school has a teacher who teaches just speech and theater. Mm-hmm. So I look around, and there were several openings, actually. This is 1966, mm-hmm. and the starting salary for a teacher in upstate New York, secondary school teacher, was $5,200 a year.
I know. So that wasn't that unusual.
No.
Right.
No.
Right.
But I looked at the thing, and there was a place called Glens Falls, New York, mm-hmm. and Glens Falls was paying $5,500 a year. I said, I'm going to Glens Falls. Never heard of it. Never been there.
Right.
So I went. I drove out to Glens Falls. Had an interview and got the job.
Wow.
So I was very, very lucky. And that's because I student taught at Tresper Clark on Long Island in Old Westbury.
I see.
Yeah, yeah.
So you already had experience.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
So.
Okay, so then here you are what you were aiming at.
Four of the happiest years of my life.
Wow.
Lifelong friends. I still get invited back to the student class reunions. I was there for 4 years. I had no intent. All I did was, these were gifted kids. We won, you know, the New York State one-act play contest like 2 years in a row. We did. They were just wonderful. And they were curious about how they could get into theater themselves.
They were serious.
Some of them were serious. And some of them were gifted enough to do it. And I really didn't have the answers to that professional aspect of it. So I said, well, I'll take a year's leave of absence, and I'll go to New York, and I'll do all the things.
I'll do research.
Yeah, you know, I'll do all the things you need to do. I'll try to do it myself, blah, 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 blah.
Amazing.
Now, in the meantime, in the meantime, a friend of mine and I, we weren't friends at the time, we were just kind of acquaintances, started a theater company in upstate New York. It was originally called the Riverbend Players, and then we found an old carriage house in Lake George, and we became Towers Hall Playhouse, because that was the name of the carriage house. And for 7 years, we did summer stock in Lake George, and then it's...
Wait a minute, we did. What did you do?
I was the co-producer, director, sometimes actor. I mean, the first year, we did 10 weeks of a Neil Simon Star Spangled Girl, the worst play he ever wrote, and I was in it, directed it, and did some of the PR.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know,
right,
summer
right.
stock, you do everything.
Everything. Right. Yeah, right.
I don't think I painted the scenery, but...
But you would have if I had tried. Right.
So that was going, I was working there during the summers, and so I go to New York. And I started, those were the days when you could still visit agents personally.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't all email,
right,
you know.
Right, and
so,
digital.
And digital. And so you had your, so I started making the rounds. And about the third agent I went to sent me out for a commercial audition. And I got the commercial. And it was for a Procter & Gamble product, a Downy fabric softener. And in those days, Procter & Gamble sponsored all the soap operas.
That's right.
During, you know, when soap operas were huge. And its biggest soap opera was Search for Tomorrow, which is no longer on. But, so I did the thing, and it was the first thing where you say, Downey, the April fresh smell of Downey, he noticed, you know, I was a bridegroom, and I'm smelling my shirt, and I say, oh, honey, this smells fresh. And she says, he noticed the April fresh smell of Downey. Well, I get a check for, you know, the first time it's shown, and right. thing, and the check was more than I made a whole year teaching. So I said, ooh, this is fun. I'm liking this. So fortunately, I then, that kind of came to me sort of easily. About 2 weeks later, I got a gig as one of the banjo players with the Doublemint Twins. And I don't play the banjo at all. I was just, you know, miming it. And I did another, Stokely Van Camp Pork and Beans, which was another, two other ones that just ran forever. You know, in the days when they'd run a commercial for 3 years. So I was very lucky. And the school called and said, you know, you're on a leave of absence. Are you coming back?
Right.
And I said, I'm not going to. I had trained a student teacher. So they had somebody ready to roll.
I said,
why don't you hire my wonderful student teacher, which they did, and that was...
It's probably just as well. If you had gone back to school and said, oh, this is a piece of cake, don't worry about it. You'll go to New York, you'll find an agent, you'll get...
I have all these kids with me.
Right. Good. Because I don't have to tell you that your experience was an anomaly.
Oh, totally.
You know, right?
Totally.
I mean, it was an amazing, wonderful thing, but it isn't the way it is.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. Exactly. Yeah. So, okay, so now you've got income. I mean, you've got money coming in regularly. You know.
So anyhow, then I... it's 1970, and I'm doing all of these from 70 to 73. I'm doing, you know, and I'm auditioning for things, and I along the way, I make my movie debut opposite Barbara Streisand in The Way We Were.
Oh, my God.
I have one line. Yeah. I think it's the height of my life. So, but along the way, I got a call from some friends that I knew from college. And they were starting a theater in Rochester, New York, in Rochester. Geneseo had been about 30 miles south of Rochester. And so they're starting this theater in Rochester called Jiva for Genesee Valley Arts Center. And would I come and be one of the American actor-directors? They were going to have four actor-directors from the United States and four from the National Theater of Great Britain. And we're going to start this theater, and everybody's going to act and direct and blah, blah, blah. And it's going to be rotating rep.
Wow.
Which we never, ever do in this country. So rarely do in this country. And they knew that I had experience of opening a theater and knew what,
you'd already done that
on a much smaller scale.
Right.
So they wanted me to join, and I thought, well, I'll go up. They said, would you just come up and do the first show? And the first show was a Tom Stoppard play called After Magritte. And I said, yeah, okay, yeah, sure, I'll come up and do that. Well, I went up and I worked with them. I had a very small role in After Magritte, but I fell in love with the other actors, with the whole idea, I was still very much into this, we're always all a family, which I try to exercise even today, you know, make everybody a little family, away from home. And for 4 years, I did, from October to May, I did rotating rep at Jiva, doing five major productions at night and five noontime production acts. So it was like you were in a constant state of learning and rehearsing.
If it's Tuesday, it's Stoppard. If it's not right.
Yes, exactly. If it's Wednesday, it's Simon.
So I just want to comment that this seems to have happened to you. You know, I mean, they say, well, there's this course at Geneseo, you know, why don't you check it out? You go up there and you say, whoa, this is for me. And then they say, well, there's this acting, you know, there's this theater. And you say, well, I'm not sure, but I'll come up. And you say, whoa, this is for me. It's like life keeps throwing these things at you that you don't know about.
When I have little career days, people sometimes ask me to do career days.
Right.
I always say to the people, if you're really interested in theater, say yes.
To everything.
Yeah.
Right.
Say yes, because something is going to materialize.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, believe me, I went to 150 commercial auditions.
Right.
My heart was broken when I didn't become one of the Budweiser taste buds on Saturday Night Live. So, you know, it wasn't always joy.
No, I didn't mean to suggest that. What I meant to suggest was that you found yourself in places that were for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's because I had maybe the courage to say yes.
Yes, I agree.
I want to do that. And I think that...
I agree. I think it's true. Yeah. I think it's true. It's lovely.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Because while I was at Jiva, the 4 years I was at Jiva, in 1976, I came across this play, which I was in, which somebody had seen at the Pitlochry Festival in Scotland
right. The
summer before. And they got this version of a play called Who Done It, and it was based on this German play, Scherenschnitt, and we did it at Jiva. And it was a huge hit at Jiva under the name Who Done It. And at the end of 4 years, the patrons and subscribers at Jiva got to vote what play they'd most like to see again. And Who Done It was the number one play. It was the base for Sheer Madness.
Oh, my God.
So that's the...
It just falls in your lap.
I wrote to my partner, my business partner, Marilyn. I said, I'm going to play right now. I have it framed in my office upstate. I said, I'm going to play right now that I think would be great for us to do at the dinner theater this summer. There's a great part for me, a great part for you. I'm going to see if we can get the rights from the German author, you know.
Right.
So she and I set about finding an agent to contact the German author to see if we could get the rights. And we got them to perform the show in the summer of 1978. And so it was a huge... And these were all people who had worked at the dinner theater before. And it was all improv. I mean, the script was, you know, three pages
thick.
And we're doing, you know... And we're incorporating all this local stuff and everything into the script. And it's a comedy and it's a murder mystery.
Right.
And the audience gets involved.
Yeah.
And they get, you know, they get to sleuth some clues and everything. So... nothing like that had ever been done before. You know what I mean? In fact, when the lights would go up in the theater and the cop would say, ladies and gentlemen, this is where you come in to the audience, people would think that something had happened. You know? So that, of course, from 1970, it was such a big hit, we did it the following year. And people would say to us, every week you'd have certain buses coming, and one day, like on Tuesdays, you'd have buses come in from Boston, and, you know, these would be either, tour groups, or, you know, and so every Tuesday we'd have this bus in from Boston, and they said to us, when are you going to bring this play to Boston? And we said, we don't know. So we had thought that maybe we'd bring it right to New York, but... we said, why don't we do it in Boston? Try it out. See how, you know, blah, blah, blah. So Marilyn and I were then playing in same time next year every night. And every Sunday after we were finished with our show, we'd drive over to Boston looking for theaters. And finally found the Charles Playhouse Stage 2. And in 1980, we opened the show there, January 29th, 1980. And it's still running. So, and it's in its 20th, it's the first, second, and third longest running play in the history of the United States.
Oh, my God.
Boston is in its 34th year. The Kennedy Center is in its 26th year. It ran for 19 years in Chicago. And last month, 2 months ago, it opened in Moscow. It's in its third year in Paris. It ran for 13 years in Athens, Greece. It's in its 10th year in Poland. It's just got an award for best play in Zagreb. So, I mean, we've been all over the world. We've been to Barcelona. We've been to Rio de Janeiro, Buenos Aires, Melbourne, Australia, Wellington. I mean, we've been...
Oh, my God.
It's running in Seoul tonight. So...
My God.
It's fun. It's incredible. We have a map in our office.
With the pins
in it. Right. Yeah. I said, oh, we're missing a pin.
So yet again, it falls in your lap.
Yeah.
And you're smart enough to say yes.
Well.
But it falls in your lap. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Great. So,
then.
Yeah.
Then it gets to the point where for 25 years, for 25 years, that's my total
life. I was just going to say, this is all consuming. This is a full-time job.
I'm starring in it,
right,
for 10 years.
Right.
Never a day off. And I'm directing the shows I'm in.
And you're producing it.
And my partner and I are producing it.
Right.
And she's also in it.
Right.
And we're rewriting it.
It's a full-time job.
Yeah, but it's also a mom-and-pop operation.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
As my schedule lightens a little bit, I have other people I've trained who can do what I can do. So I am now free to do other little projects myself. And the Jiva Theater that I was in the founding company of, they've asked me back a couple of times to do things. FST wanted to do Sheer Madness, I came down to direct it and met everybody in FST, and I guess they like me enough. I mean, Richard has been so generous to me. Mm-hmm. He has asked me back to do Perfect Wedding. And he's asked me back to do The Underpants.
And let's talk about The Underpants.
Yeah.
So you said who wrote it and who adapted it. Just tell me whatever it is you want people to know about it.
Well, it's 1910 Dusseldorf, Germany, as seen through Steve Martin's eyes. And, it's a very, it's got plenty of comedy in it. It also has a couple of little storylines that are interesting. It has a little bit to do with the ascension of women, which mm-hmm. was, I mean, because in the original, Carl Sternheim, first scene of the play, the man is literally beating his wife with a rod.
Aye.
You know? And so, it shows the importance of women in the society, mm-hmm. and it also, I think, is very interesting for us today when we're involved in all these reality shows, which I'm not involved in at all.
Right.
But it's about 15 minutes of fame, and how people deal with 15 minutes of fame.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great.
So
that's great. Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah. Did you know the play before?
This is the third time I've done it.
Oh.
I had done it in my little theater up in Lake George when it was still in manuscript form. And then I suggested it to the artistic director at Jiva, and he said, oh, yeah, we hadn't read this yet. Let's do it. And they had a big success with it at Jiva. And so I suggested it to Richard, and he said, he said, I've heard of it, haven't read it lately, and he said, well, would you like to direct it? And I said, well, yeah, I hadn't suggested it to him for that reason, but he asked me if I'd direct it, and so here I am. And it's wonderful, because when you direct something three times, or four times, or five times, certain things that you learn,
yes.
that make it so much easier. I mean, I said I can't wait to direct Perfect Wedding again because I learned something in this last production that I now have to bring to all the other productions I do, you know.
No, I understand it. Yeah. I understand it. And it also makes you such a better choice to direct if you've directed it before. You're not starting from square one, right? Right. Yeah, no, it's wonderful. Okay, so the other question that I ask, I'll be curious to hear what you do with this, is just, you know, having given a life to the theater, which you clearly have, is there anything you'd want to say about what that's like?
Well, you know, the theater is either chicken or feathers.
Yes, oh, I've never heard anybody say that.
but you know, it is. I mean, right now I have this lovely cast, all of whom were our number one choices for the roles, and we're forming this, and they're forming as I leave, this wonderful family, and it's great. But if you're not part of that cast, if you're sitting home thinking, "Gee, I was number two," you know, it's then theater isn't as much
it's
fun.
It's feathers, yeah.
So you have to be prepared. Every, you know, in theater, it's always, "What have you done for me lately?" Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
It's not, "Gee, I was awfully good in as Snoopy in You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown," right, in 1973.
not even that. I just interviewed a woman who told me that she was up for a role on Broadway. And they auditioned all these people, and she was, you know, the last person or the last two or whatever. And the director came over to her and said, "You're wonderful at this. You would be wonderful at this, but the star has decided to use the person she used before, who wasn't even in the
room."
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, there wasn't anything she could do about that.
Well, you know, the little story I always recount in my own mind is the first Broadway production of Grease. They're auditioning for the class president. Mm-hmm. And at the time I was this skinny and I auditioned and went through the process, and it was down to two of us. Mm-hmm. It was down to another guy and me, and we got on stage and we both danced with Patricia Birch, and mm-hmm. you know, we both did the hand jive and the whole thing, and the other guy got it, and I was crushed. And then when you look back, you say, and if you'd done that, you never would have gone back to Jiva, you never would have found Sheer Madness, you would never would have had a life all over the world the way you do. I mean, I'm so glad, and I know it. I say a little prayer every night saying, "Thanks a lot, everybody, whoever's listening."
I love that. And actually, I think that's a great place to stop. Thank you very much.
Oh, well, thank you, Lynn. This has been joyous.
Bruce Jordan is joyous. That is the thing that mostly comes across when you listen to him. And so here you have it, a man who can say, "I say a prayer every night, thanking whoever, right, for this glorious life, the life he was really meant to live." And who knows, maybe there are angels sweeping his path. But what I know is that he said yes. He followed wherever he was led. And when he found himself in a place that felt good, even though he didn't anticipate that that was going to be so, he said yes. He said yes because he knew inside of himself that this was his, that this was right, that this was good. And he didn't get stuck. He decided early on he wanted to be a teacher. Okay, fine. He pursued that, and that was joyous. Remember, he said four of the happiest years of his life. And yet, when he found himself in the acting arena, you know, he said, "Wow, this is terrific. I'll stay here." He knew what felt right for him, and he didn't resist it. He didn't say, oh no, but I have to be this. Oh no, but I decided to be that. Oh no, but they wanted me to be this. Oh no, but they wouldn't like it if I. He didn't do any of that. He asked himself what he wanted to do, and then he did it. So, of course, this is what I am attempting to communicate to whoever is listening, that there is a rightness. There is the life you were meant to live. There is something that when you're in it, time doesn't matter. Judgment doesn't happen. Criticism doesn't exist. When you're in it, you're in it. Now, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art because it's so clear when you hear it from them. But I do not mean to suggest that everybody has to be an artist. Not at all. Well, last week we heard Elliot talk about being a lawyer. Even though he is also an actor and a director, he really got off on what he was doing as a lawyer. And actually, the week before you heard Mary Testa say, well, let me see, should I be a lawyer or should I be an actor? Right? But it isn't about lawyer or actor. It isn't even about career or job or vocation. It's about minute to minute feeling that you are being yourself. Minute to minute, not saying, should I, might I, ought I? No, no. Yes, I am. I'm interested in, I like to read. I like to read mystery fiction. You know, my parents think it's foolish and frivolous, but I really like to read mystery fiction. Or I like to read romance novels. Or I don't like to read. I'd much prefer to listen to music. And the music that I like, lots of people don't like it, but I love it. You know, or I like to walk. My spouse wants to drive everywhere, but I love to walk. And sometimes I just want to say, okay, honey, you drive and I'll meet you there. Or I just go off on a walk by myself because I love to walk. Or I don't know if you saw the movie Julia, in which she's playing Julia Child. And there's this wonderful scene in which she can't figure out what to do, and her husband, the diplomat, he's very busy and he's got his, you know, his stuff, and he says, well, what do you like? And she says, well, I like to eat. And of course, she became Julia Child, right? Because she knew what she loved, and she said yes to it. Not that long ago, I had a client, a nurse, came to me. She had a terrible nervous breakdown. First it started with her not wanting to go to work, and then finally she just broke down in tears at work and had to leave. And of course it turned out that she never wanted to be a nurse. And but that's what her family thought she should be. That was the safe career, and anyway. Finally, her unconscious rebelled completely and said, no more of this, we can't do this anymore. And in her recovery, I suggested that she get a bunch of magazines and she cut out any pictures or articles or stories or anything that looked interesting to her. And what she discovered was that everything she cut out had to do with food, not unlike Julia Child. And she went to chef school and is now happily a cook. Please don't wait. Well, if you have to wait for your unconscious to break you down, it's okay, because then you have an opportunity to find it. But it isn't necessary to break down to find it. Well, you know, again, I want to take that back. For a lot of people, it is necessary to break down to find it. So if you're breaking down and you're worried about it and you want to talk to me about it, call me. If you have some hint about who you really are and that you're not being that person and you haven't had to break down yet, it doesn't have to be me, but get help. Get somebody to help you to find you. You deserve it. You deserve to, like Bruce, every night say a little prayer of thanks, if not to the angels sweeping your path, to yourself, for your courage to be yourself. Okay, so, as always, I hope that you got something you can use from this show. And I don't care what it is, but I hope it'll bring you back, because I will be here next week. Same time, same station. And as always, I hope you will be, too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night.